Hello, it is now 5 o'clock here at CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and you are listening to The Corridor, bringing you local and regional news from Kingston and the surrounding area, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and for our podcasts, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie on Kingston City Council's option considerations for driveway windrow clearing services.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. It's a moment many Kingston residents have experienced more than once this winter. The snowplow finally clears your street and leaves a heavy ridge of snow across the end of your driveway. Councillor Ryan Boehm spoke to this issue in a motion he brought forward at Tuesday's City Council meeting.
We know that, you know, that the defeat you feel when you're done shoveling your driveway, especially after the winter we've just had, and that snowplow comes around the corner and you're like, yay, the snowplow! And then he goes by your driveway and leaves these massive chunks that you have no hope of clearing. And you're kind of like, yay, the snowplow.
Windrows created through municipal snowplowing operations are not only a nuisance, but can also present accessibility and service challenges for residents, particularly seniors, persons with disabilities, and households with limited capacity to remove heavy or compacted snow. Several other Ontario municipalities have implemented driveway windrow clearing programs using specialized equipment with a range of service models, eligibility criteria, and funding approaches. Boehm's motion, which received unanimous support from council, will have the city examine the possibility of implementing a similar driveway windrow clearing service in Kingston.
This is more just to explore what's the actual cost of having what other municipalities have, that extra little arm that comes down and essentially just pushes that, right? So it would push it into a bank. The technology exists, other places around us do it. But we don't really understand what it would cost, how it would be implemented, and we're just lacking information. So realistically, this starts that conversation. It's going to give us the information, and then we'll be able to make better informed decisions going forward. I'm kind of in favor of it. I'd love to see this report come back. And realistically, we know that, you know, there's people with disabilities and accessibility issues. We know we have a large senior population. So, I mean, there's a lot of the community that's been asking for this quite some time. And when I started digging into it, realized there was a massive information gap on what the costs would actually be and how we could implement this. So that's basically what we're looking to have that conversation and get some better information on this.
Councillors around the horseshoe were supportive, citing what they've heard from their constituents on the issue over the years.
I have received a number of complaints from constituents who are predominantly senior citizens and concerns about accessibility. And so having seen this service been provided in other municipalities, I was more than happy to second the motion.
And I've also had some seniors like come in and approach me and contact me about, you know, it's like I've had to pay somebody three times today just to clear my driveway because the plow went by three times. And then, you know, and then it's like that the next day and then the next day. And then it ends up being where it's, you know, it's not an affordable thing to sustain. And I just think that this is really worth exploring because I think this is something that would really, the quality of life for the residents would be drastically improved, especially during the winter months and especially with the winter like we just had, so.
A lot of constituents in my district, they asked during the campaign and after the campaign why we cannot do this when other municipalities doing. And I think it's very important when you wake up 6 o'clock in the morning, you wanna go to work, and you just clean your driveway. And after 10 minutes, you went to get shower, change the clothes, you came back, and then it's like a 2 feet, 3 feet high again, the snow in your driveway. And sometime you early evening or late evening, you clean your driveway In the morning, you came back and you see the pile up snow again, which is also frozen. And then you have to just do it, and it's take your time, and you are late from work, especially for the senior population in our city. It's very difficult, and I think it is a good idea to look into the information, and if we can implement, and that would be great for the people living in this country. It's a great service to provide them.
City staff will now prepare a report examining clearing service models and their applicability to Kingston. The report, expected by the end of the third quarter of 2026, will include a review of programs in comparable municipalities, along with an assessment of potential service delivery options for Kingston, including associated costs, operational implications, benefits, limitations, funding considerations, and impacts on the city's ability to meet minimum maintenance standards. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Christina. Now over to CFRC's Henry Walker with a story by Michelle Dory Forstel, LJI reporter for the Kingstonist, about Napanee Town Council's approval of flexible workplace policies for staff.
Thank you, Dinah. The Council of the Town of Greater Napanee approved a new flexible workplace policy at its meeting on Tuesday, March 10th, 2026, after an extended debate over how to monitor and review regularly scheduled work-from-home arrangements. The policy formalizes practices that staff say have already been occurring informally across municipal departments, allowing eligible employees to work remotely in certain circumstances while maintaining that most municipal staff continue to work full-time in the office. At Tuesday's council meeting, staff said the policy is intended to provide clearer expectations and greater consistency in handling remote work requests across the organization. Our municipality has been working towards formalizing a number of practices into policy, Holly Knapp-Fisher, Human Resources Manager for the town, told Council. While this practice has been functioning informally with success across all of our departments, the absence of a formal policy has resulted in variations in how flexible work is requested, approved, and monitored. Staff said formalizing the policy will help ensure remote work requests are assessed consistently across departments while maintaining operational needs and service levels. Under the policy, full-time remote positions are not supported, and staff told council that most municipal employees continue to work in person and that structured remote work assignments remain uncommon. I think it's important to note that all of our staff are currently full-time in-office workers, Knapp-Fisher said. Of our 90 full-time employees, we have 3 in-place remote agreements as it stands right now. 2 of those employees work from home one day a week, while a third works remotely one day every other week. Most remote work requests involve occasional situations such as snow days, childcare needs, or the need to be at home for service appointments. The majority of our active remote work agreements are flexible in nature, those one-off events like your kid is sick or your internet provider gives you a 5-hour window and you need to be home, Knapp-Fisher said. While councillors broadly support such occasional flexibility, much of the discussion focused on provisions allowing reoccurring remote work schedules. Councillor Mike Schenck said he supported flexibility for short-term situations, but he expressed some concern about regularly scheduled work-from-home arrangements. If you have to work from home because something pops up, I don't have a problem with that, Schenck said. But when it comes to fixed arrangements, you have to make sure it's being policed. Schenck said municipal staff ultimately work for the public, and residents sometimes expect to see a face when they visit municipal offices. He also questioned how structured arrangements would be overseen, warning that he believes productivity can drop when superiors are not present. He suggested that, in that case, employees begin to think, "Why should I be here if the boss isn't here?" Well, he said that he trusts municipal staff, Schenck stressed the importance of ensuring remote work is monitored so service levels and accountability are maintained. Other councillors said remote work would be appropriate in some circumstances and should remain an option when justified. Councillor Angela Hicks pointed out that some types of work may be easier to complete outside a busy office environment. The difference between working from home in dead silence and working in an office is huge, Hicks said, especially when you're working with numbers or any sort of large volume of technical data. She said the key issue is whether employees meet their responsibilities, not where they work. If it can be justified, I have absolutely no problem with it, structured or flexible. The discussion reflects a broader debate about remote work across the public sector, one that research suggests is more than just a matter of preference. Data from the June 2024 Survey on Employment and Skills, a multi-year research partnership conducted by the Environix Institute for Survey Research, in collaboration with the Future Skills Center and Diversity Institute, shows that remote work is no longer just a pandemic-era experiment, but rather a structural shift in how Canadians work. About 2 in 5 workers now work from home at least one day per week, while 2/3 would like the option to do so, highlighting widespread demand for flexibility. Most workers agree that home-based employees are just as productive as those in offices, and that remote work makes the workplace more enjoyable. The trend also has shifted the economic landscape of city centers, with fewer employees commuting downtown. Restaurants, cafes, and small businesses are seeing fewer customers, underscoring the broader societal effects of a workforce increasingly splitting its time between home and office. A 2-year study by Stanford University found that remote employees were 13% more productive, largely because they faced fewer distractions and could focus more deeply on complex tasks. Similarly, research from the U.S. National Bureau of Economics Research shows workers worldwide reinvest roughly 40% of the time saved from commuting back into their jobs. Despite this evidence, both the Government of Ontario and the Government of Canada have, in recent years, required more employees to return to their offices, citing benefits such as collaboration, supervision, and consistency across departments. Officials also point to the broader economic impact. With fewer workers commuting downtown, local small businesses have been seeing customer declines, highlighting the ripple effects of remote work on city cores. Critics, including public sector unions, argue that remote work can improve productivity and help retain and attract talent, leaving municipalities to balance flexibility with accountability and public access to staff. The town's chief administrative officer, CAO, Matthew Grant, told council that the policy was brought forward in part to formalize existing practices and ensure council was comfortable with how remote work arrangements are managed. The reason this is here before you is that this sort of stuff is already happening, he said. He wanted to formalize it and have the conventions with you in a public forum. Grant added that offering some flexibility has helped municipalities attract and retain employees. We've already benefited from that by drawing in some real good talent, he said. During the discussion, Mayor Terry Richardson raised concerns about remote work agreements that could continue indefinitely without review. I'm not content with open-ended contracts, he told council. Council ultimately amended the policy to remove wording that allowed structured remote work arrangements without a defined review period. Under the amendment, reoccurring remote work agreements must now be reviewed annually. Council then voted to approve the policy as amended late in the meeting, formally establishing guidelines for remote work arrangements within the municipality. Meetings of the Council of the Town of Greater Napanee can be virtually or watched afterward on the Napanee Town Council YouTube channel or attended in person in Council Chambers at Napanee Town Hall, 124 John Street. Further information about Council meetings, including agendas and reports, is available on the Town's Civic Web portal.
Thank you, Henry, and to Michelle Dory Forstell of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little, LJI reporter for CJPE County FM in Picton, about local underwater explorer Jill Heinerth.
Jill Heinerth is a world-renowned underwater explorer, cave diver, writer, photographer, and filmmaker. She recently gave a talk in Picton, Prince Edward County, where she shared her experiences traveling the globe exploring underwater caves deep beneath Earth's surface, guiding scientists through zero visibility and cramped caves, risking her life on any given mission. But her photos and film clips revealed not only the claustrophobic feeling of cave diving, but the wonder of discovering remnants of ancient civilization and new deep water species. She is not fearless. In fact, there is a fear in every mission, but her careful preparation and checklists help her make it home. She tells us how cave diving became her passion.
You know, you wanted to be an astronaut. Tell me about that and what
I remember in public school, we would be herded into the library to the black and white television so we could all watch the Apollo missions. And I remember seeing, in particular, men driving around in the lunar rovers and thinking, wow, you know, that's what I want to do. And also, at the same time period, we were all watching Jacques Cousteau on Sunday nights, so exploration TV, you know? And that gave us something to talk about at school Monday morning, and that stuck with me.
And your mother was supportive of being an astronaut?
Well, my mom said, gosh, there's no Canadian space program, there's no girl astronauts. But she was always encouraging me to learn and be curious, and yeah. It's so funny. She doesn't understand how I came to do this stuff, but I see the roots of the qualities of her in everything that I do. I think she was a very adventurous and courageous young woman. When she was just a child here, she actually rescued another kid from a collapsed excavation pit here in Picton and received an award for that. And I remember even in my youth, like looking at that silver tray and going, wow, you know, that's my mom, the hero.
You know? It's in your blood. How old were you when you first started diving? And
My very first dive was actually in a swimming pool at the age of 16, but I didn't have the financial resources to take a diving class until I was in university. So I saved my money, knew that I wanted to do it, and from the moment that I had the opportunity to take a class and dive, it was a pivot point in my life.
How did you become interested in cave diving, though? I mean, you're the ultimate diver. How did you become interested in that?
Well, I was the little kid that would build a fort inside the kitchen cupboard or the top shelf of the closet, these dark, cozy places, and loved the outdoors, too. But I also grew up hiking on the Bruce Trail in those cracks and crevices in the limestone. And so when I had the opportunity to move into a three-dimensional environment underwater, I went, oh, yes, this is it, yeah.
Your presentation was amazing, and it gave me the heebie-jeebies sometimes. I can tell you that. When you talked about, you know, your chest is on the bottom and your shoulders are touching the top of it, it just... I don't know how you do it, but obviously it's in your blood again.
Yeah, it is. But I don't take risks needlessly. I'm very careful about how I plan, and I'm willing to take risks when it brings back data and information for science, for outreach, things that we didn't know about before. So it's got to have a higher mission for me in order to take on those risks.
It's not just a matter of, oh, that sounds challenging. No. I think I'm going to just do it.
Yeah, no, yeah. Not at all. It's always about working with scientists, extending the reach into these, you know, remote places and increasing our understanding of our planet. Because right now we know more about space than we do about caves and deep ocean environments. So hopefully I can fill in the blanks.
And especially about water.
Yes, absolutely. The most important issue of the next generation to protect our drinking water resources, and our oceans, which are the lungs of the planet, producing the very oxygen that we breathe.
Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Oh, gosh. I think I would just like to encourage everybody to kind of engage their inner explorer, you know, get a little bit afraid, step into it, and, you know, go out into the natural world and learn and experience.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
And thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Up next, we have Juliana Gonsalves reading a story by Keith Dempsey, LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, on the passage of the town of Gananoque's municipal budget after the expiration of the 30-day amendment period.
Thank you, Dinah. The town of Gananoque's 2026 municipal budget was not formally voted on by council, but rather deemed passed under Ontario's strong mayor legislation after the 30-day amendment period expired without a formal council motion to adopt or amend the plan. Mayor John Beddoes said he had intended to veto the budget after council's final draft underfunded capital reserves by roughly $450,000, which he argued would jeopardize the town's asset management plan and long-term infrastructure funding strategy. A subsequent legal opinion led Beddoes to allow the budget to move forward without a veto. Under the province's strong mayor framework, the mayor proposes a draft budget and council has 30 days to amend it. If no amendment is formally passed within that window, the mayor's budget is considered adopted. The approved budget carries a property tax increase of 8.94%, slightly lower than the original draft's 9.6%. For the average residential homeowner, the levy increase equates to 8.68%, or roughly $12 per month for every $100,000 of assessed property value. The median assessed home value in Gananoque is $197,000, meaning the typical homeowner will see a $23 per month increase, or $276 per year. Beto said the increase is needed to address long-term infrastructure pressures. Town estimates show Gananoque faces roughly $97 million in infrastructure needs over the next decade, while only about $70 million in funding has been identified. He framed the tax hike as a fiscally conservative measure intended to ensure the town raises sufficient revenue to maintain services and fund obligations, noting that relying heavily on one-time revenue sources such as casino proceeds would be unpredictable. The budget also includes a 1% increase in water and wastewater rates, attributed in part to a recently announced provincial grant. Beddoes is emphasizing a focus on reducing future tax pressures by leveraging tools such as asset sales, service level changes, and strategic budgeting, while avoiding repeating past underfunding.
Thank you, Juliana. Coming up now is Ted Evans, LGR reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, about the relocation of leisure programming in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Loyalist Township will be running a programming pilot through the spring and summer as they look to transition the use of the Leisure and Activity Center to the W.J. Henderson Community Center. Council approved a staff recommendation to formally close the Leisure and Activity Center as a direct programming space on August 1st, 2026. Staff's report noted the programming pilot will help ensure service continuity while improving operational efficiency and optimizing the use of township recreation assets. With leisure programming, fitness amenities, aquatics, library services, and select municipal payment services under one roof, staff says it offers residents a more convenient, connected, and accessible experience. They also noted increased public transit access at the W.J. Henderson Community Center. The Leisure and Activity Center has served as a secondary municipal programming space for many years. However, staff's report noted its condition, accessibility limitations, and operational inefficiencies have increasingly challenged its long-term viability. Recent reviews and facility condition assessments have identified significant capital needs, including HVAC modernization, accessibility retrofits, and life cycle renewal. Projected annual operating savings from the service consolidation are estimated to be between $55,900 and $92,600. $600 in recurring cashable savings, as well as 28 to 32 hours per week in staffing efficiencies. Manager of Recreation Parks and Facilities with the Township, Matthew Sobalski, explained the recommendation.
We did look at the life cycle and the asset replacement of some core essential items that are included in that facility. And as we're nearing some further additional financial pressures that are experienced within the Rec FM division, we've determined that for the best course of action moving forward to remove that pressure from our sustainable services moving forward is to not segment our services and try to move towards additional savings that would be associated with, let's say, delaying potential capital projects.
Sobalski spoke about the evaluation process for the programming pilot.
We do have three pivot periods that are built into the trial plan that outline if we're not necessarily meeting milestones that are anticipated, we will have a review period at that point. The goal is to have our residents participate that are over at the LEC as users, participating in the pilot program over at the WJH. And then there will be a pilot evaluation framework that we'll be asking users, instructors, as well as staff to all complete.
Councillor Paul Broderick noted his concerns with the programming pilot and staff recommendation.
My concern is that when you put a hard date on something and do a trial run before that, it almost looks like the decision's made before the trial run. And honestly, I'm having trouble seeing a class in that community room, given my experience with the facility.
Residents who use the Leisure and Activity Center regularly brought concerns to council, including the size of the space, privacy, and the costs associated.
The community room at the Henderson Center is quite small. I don't personally understand how you could fit 16 people in there, given the size of the exercise requirements. Right now, the Henderson Center does not have, in my opinion, appropriate facilities to run exercise programming.
There's a bigger picture here, and it's not just about dollars and cents.
Right now, the community that participates in the Leisure Center, we're anxious because to put an August 1st date and then do trial runs through this spring, we've all taken a hike over to the W.J. Henderson to see what facilities will be available, and it doesn't suit what we're providing. And I understand the idea of making everything in one building, but it looks like there was no consideration done to build a leisure facility with fitness components to it.
We're talking dollars and cents or something that we need. You close it down, the building's still going to be there. Why are they thinking of forcing us into that little room which takes 16 people? It just doesn't make sense. There's a time for dollars and cents, and this is not the time for dollars and cents. We're a senior center. It's the only thing that we have in this area, and it should be kept going.
Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend addressed concerns.
I understand the concerns raised by residents, but it's more than simply dollars and cents. The dollars and cents are that this township's invested nearly $50 million in a recreation facility that is part of a recreation master plan to consolidate. And change is difficult, but this is the direction that we, as a council have chosen. And I think we need to follow through with that said. I think there needs to be very careful attention paid to the impacts of that change on the residents who have spoken, and provision for council to be able to keep touch with them and address those concerns how we may following the pilot.
Cebulski spoke about how staff are addressing concerns as well.
We have taken some considerations for some assessments regarding privacy requirements at the WJAH community room. So some of those considerations are for privacy screenings, as well as spatial needs for the space or for the area and the layout. There is a capacity of that community room of around 60 participants to be in that space for general meeting purposes. And we have used a formulatic approach to outline our capacities that for certain classes would be 12 to 16 in capacity, 16 to 20 in other areas, depending on programming and specific needs. Outside of the privacy assessment that would be implemented to, let's say, upgrade the features of that community space to be utilized for a direct programming facet, we have looked at a scheduling matrix and paradigm regarding additional outlets for access. So this would include additional programming schedules for early morning programs, afternoon programs, evening programs.
After staff and council weighed in, it was a close 3-2 vote in favor of the recommendation. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
And thank you to Ted Evans for that story, and also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region. Coming up tonight, we'll have clear skies and a low -4. On Wednesday, we'll see a mix of sun and cloud with a 40% chance of rain showers or flurries during the day with a high +5 and at night with a low of 0. On Thursday night, we'll have cloudy skies with a 60% chance of rain and a high +9. On Thursday night, periods of rain with a low -6. And the outlook for Friday is sunny skies with a high of 0 and clear at night with a low -10. And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.